welcome to Wild Connection, the podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Jennifer Vertelin. I'm a scientist and author that studies animal behavior. I'm passionate about animals, and I love helping people reconnect with nature to live better lives. This podcast is about you, other animals, and how we're all connected in this wild and crazy thing called life. Hi, everyone, and welcome back to Wild Connection, the podcast. As many of you know, I'm coming to you live from windy, impenetrable forest in Uganda, where I'm currently a Fulbright scholar. Part of my Fulbright was creating a special series, Voices of Uganda. This week features Nelson Guma, the chief warden of Bwindi Mogahenga Conservation Area. Before coming to Bwindi, he managed many of Uganda's other spectacular national parks. He has a strong background in ecological research and conservation. He also has special experience in tourism, which is important because tourism is such a big part of conservation in Uganda. And he's also an educator, not only educating tourists, but also the rangers and others responsible for protecting these incredibly important natural areas. But he's so much more than that. So let's get to know the man behind this UNESCO World Heritage Site. Welcome to the show.
Yes, it's a pleasure to have me.
Yes, it is. Before we dive into all of your experience and your perspective on what it means to be responsible for some really incredible and valuable natural resources, I'd love for people to get to know you a little bit about your background, where you're from. So can you share a little bit about where you're from?
Great. Nelson Guma is my name. I'm Ugandan. I was born in this country. I was born in the western part of Uganda where I'm working currently. My parents used to work in Mubende. That's where I was born. But my parents come from northwestern Uganda. And so that's where my cradle land is. But I was born in this area here, western part where I'm working from. And then I grew up in different parts of this country. A little bit in the east of Uganda, where you have the source of the Nile. So my childhood, I spent a little bit of it there. And then in the capital city, central of Uganda. So grew up here. And then for part of my education, I was sent back to my home in northwestern Uganda. And I did my primary education there, my secondary education. And then I came back to Central to Makerere University for my university education. And so that's why I pursued. For my undergraduate, I specialized in zoology. And for my postgraduate, then I did wildlife ecology. So by training now, I'm a wildlife ecologist.
So wow, you have lived in all the different parts of Uganda, which is really special. So I have two questions. The first is, do you have a favorite part of Uganda?
I think I've come to love the western part of Uganda, maybe because I've spent much of my time here. But this western part of Uganda has the most number of protected areas out of the 10. I think the 6 are in this part of Uganda. And during my training as an undergraduate, I used to come for field work, particularly in Chibale. There is a biological field station in Chibale, so that's where I used to come to do my field work. And so where I got accustomed to this place. And my first posting was more to the northwestern part of Uganda. So that's where I also started my career from. So given the time that I've spent, in this part of the country, I've just become accustomed to it. I've come to like it.
Yeah.
Because I've spent a lot of time in this area.
Okay. Well, so, and then I guess that leads to my next question, because you did your undergraduate at Makerere, and you also did your master's there.
Yes.
And, but what, when did you realize that you, like, what drove you to pursue that particular line? Did you always love animals? When did you know that that was what you wanted to do?
That's quite interesting. And when I was in the university, I had a cousin who were doing, of course, biological sciences, and he was a year ahead of me. And he's the one who interested me to join the Wildlife Association of the university. And so I joined the Wildlife Association of the university. And because I was doing zoology, and then I started seeing my orientation, you know, I would be probably in this direction of the of wildlife. And so when joined the Wildlife Association, then with the members, we started, you know, some conservation activities within Kampala, the city. I remember one of the plants, I don't remember the name very well, but we were working on one of those parasitic plants in the city and try to create awareness. So when I became active in the association, then they gave me one of those executive positions of being a general secretary. And so when I became the general secretary, then I would go and attend meetings, for example, the wildlife clubs of Uganda, and some conservation, you know, NGOs. And so then I started getting exposure. And then eventually I started liking, you know, wildlife, and it got a lot of interest. And so when it was time to do the postgraduate, then I went to do the wildlife ecology conservation. So I thought that was my my right place to be.
That's wonderful.
Yes.
So it's interesting, right? Because like for me, I always knew I loved wildlife, but I never thought about what that would look like, you know, as a job. Yes. And I think people would be surprised to learn that here you are in this amazing country with all of this incredible wildlife.
Yes.
And many people that live in Uganda don't actually see some of the wildlife that is here.
Yes.
Is that a true statement?
Yes. You see, in this country, I want to think that people take things for granted. They don't get the deeper meaning of things or deeper understanding. I can tell you that people around here, they know that they are gorillas, and that they are gorillas in the forest, and that's all they know.
Right. Mm-hmm.
That's all they know. That the status of these gorillas, first of all, that these gorillas are endangered. They don't know in terms of that they're actually few. This species here, the mountain gorillas, are few in the world. That one, many of the people do not know, you see. In terms of even the range, that it is probably in this the greater Virunga landscape.
Mm-hmm.
This is where they are found.
Yeah.
Many do not know. And so I think we have that problem of taking all this heritage for granted.
Yeah.
And whereas this kind of heritage, this gem, you may not find in other places. And so I think it, to me, is the problem of the appreciation of this. And perhaps because we have it, people take it for granted.
Sure.
So you only realize that this resource is very important. It's when you don't have it,
yeah.
It's when you realize it's very important.
Yeah.
So I think to me that is really the problem, that people take it for granted.
Sure.
Because we have it.
Yeah. And I think that happens in a lot of places. I know that it happens also in the United States. We have some incredible wildlife that people have never seen.
Yeah.
They don't realize maybe there's only a few.
Mm-hmm.
And they just take for granted that it's just there.
Yeah.
So when you started on your path, beginning with your postgraduate degree in wildlife ecology, you mentioned that you were at the field station in Chibali.
Yes, yes.
And so what was the first research project that you did when it came to, you know, your education?
Now, first I had to do the dissertation to fulfill the requirements for the postgraduate, the postgraduate degree. And so I did research on the human wildlife conflict. I did this in Matchin. I did a comparative study. I was looking at one part of the park which had a different array of species. And then I looked at another part which also had different species. And so I did kind of comparative study looking at the damage in quantitative terms by the different species that are there and looking at a lot of dynamics. Does it have to do with the kind of crops that are grown, which could be palatable and attracting the animals? Does it have to do with the tenure systems? You know, people leave their land to fallow. And so when you leave your land to fallow, it can provide cover, for example, for bushpigs. So these bushpigs could stay near your farmland.
Mm-hmm.
And they come out of the forest or the park, then they could get cover in the farmland, and then they go and raid.
Yeah.
So we're looking at this as well. So does distance have an effect in any way on the raiding frequencies and so on and so forth? So those are the things that was looking at. And then I also looked at the perception of the people, the real damage in the field, and how do the people perceive it? And each of those animals are responsible for raiding. For example, if a raid is done by a baboon, and then a raid is done by an elephant, how do people look at it? How do they perceive it? And which animal do they think is the worst raider? And you compare it to the real damage, are they really talking the truth, or it is a perception problem? Those were the kinds of things that I was looking at. And trying to find ways of quantifying damage, you know, some scientific way that you would use to quantify damage and say, this damage is probably this much. So that if you are comparing species, for example, the elephant and the baboons, then you'll be able to tell this amount of damage was done by the elephant and this amount of damage was done by the baboon. And then at the end of the day, from all those crop depredations in the farm and in the fields, then you're able to tell whether it is the elephant that causes the worst raid or it is the baboon.
Okay, now you have me in suspense. You have me in suspense. Who is the biggest damage raider?
Okay, if you want us to go now to the bit of the findings that I can tell you, is that we actually found that the baboon was the worst raider.
Really?
Yes, because the baboon raids frequently, but in, let's say, you know, moderate amounts, if you like, but cumulatively it's big. But the elephant raids are rare, and with elephants you only get the what we call the extreme events.
Yeah.
So it raids once, but the damage is major, and so that has an effect on the perception of the people. The extreme event, that one event, that communities look at it, since the damage is major, they will conclude based on that one extreme event.
Sure.
So they forget about the losses.
The cumulative.
Cumulative, yeah. Small losses to baboons over a period of time.
Yeah.
Cumulatively, it's just bigger than the one of the elephant.
Yeah.
So that's what I found out. And the people also were attributing the amount of damage to the size. Even if an elephant just moved through and trampled, because there's an elephant, wow, that damage is big.
Right. Well, and elephants are pretty big.
Yeah.
Yes.
But it's a big animal, so it's big.
Well, I mean, and this brings up, you know, that research really brings up a really important element that you also have to think about now in your current role, which is managing human wildlife conflict.
Correct.
And so what are some of the biggest challenges that you think you're facing, or that wildlife and humans are facing in this sort of interrelationship that we have. We live with really near next to wildlife. And so what are some of the biggest challenges that you think we face in trying to deal with some of those issues?
Okay. You see, in most cases, when you are discussing issues of human-wildlife conflict, you know, it is not why is this, and then you get the answer, the reason could be this. But in most cases, I tell people that we need to start looking at the bigger picture to begin with. And you start looking at the protected area systems at that scale. Now, if you look at Uganda and you look at the protected areas in Uganda, it still occupies about 11% of the land surface. Now, in the past, when most of these parks were gazetted in the 50s, some in the 60s, then the human population was low. And in their original design, there were what we call dispersal areas.
Mm-hmm.
There were dispersal areas, and then there was also consumptive use. So what would happen is that if the wildlife population would increase the national park, then they would disperse. There were areas where they would disperse. And because, you know, the numbers were high, then the consumptive use was being promoted, and people would be licensed to do maybe sport hunting and so on. And so you could see the issues of value of wildlife there. People are seeing value of wildlife, of course, the consumptive bit of it. But also because the population was low, and then there wasn't much interaction. You wouldn't see really wildlife damaging and all that. Then the other thing is that there were also migratory corridors.
Okay.
Though they were not gazetted, but they were there. So wildlife could easily move from one protected area to another.
Okay.
People were, you know, the population was sparse, there was sparse settlement, and so there were areas where wildlife could move. And so starting from that picture, what has changed? So there has been change in land use over time as a result of population growth. So when you look at the history of Uganda, there were economic activities that were promoted. If you read the history of Uganda, you'll hear at one time there was an economic war, a campaign to boost production of cash crops.
Mm-hmm.
So that the economy could recover.
Right.
And so some of these dispersal areas now were given out to people to cultivate cotton, in most cases.
Okay.
Cotton. And so when that happened, then the range of wildlife started shrinking, which means wildlife was being confined now more into the legally gazetted parks and wildlife reserves.
Right.
And then later these corridors were settled. And so that disrupted the migration of wildlife. So wildlife could not easily move. Now, where we are, the protected areas are getting insularized. That there is high population around the protected areas without the corridors, the animals can't move out. And so these protected areas are now becoming islands without connectivity.
Right.
And so this is now where the challenge is. Now, when you see, for example, an elephant, a matriarch that is 50 years or more, will still remember that there used to be a salt lake around there. So where there is a high population or high population density, people are settled around the protected areas, and you find that herd of elephants will try to get out to go to, you know, a salt lake somewhere. So in the process, they will encounter crops.
Sure.
So those are the kinds of crop raids we're seeing now. So when the animals are trying to move out, they encounter crops. And from my experience, most of the damage is as a result of trampling. Not that the animals don't have food, and because of that, they are, of course, those are rich cultivars, fine. But they intentionally go there to raid the rich cultivars. No. In most cases, the crops of farmers are trampled when the animals try to go out, you know, to some of the areas where they think they have their exceptional resources that they used to visit. But they now encounter homesteads, they encounter fields, and so this is now where the challenge is. The population growth is high, and the land use is incompatible with the conservation. And then also, you find that the habitat quality also in the parks, because of the invasives as a result of probably climate change, is also declining. And so you find animals do not find probably good forage and try to find, you know, also food elsewhere. So that forces them, you know, to move out when the habitat quality is not very good because of the invasives. And so we now see that kind of dynamics taking place, which to me is the biggest challenge that we have. So to put in place interventions that you want to stop the wild animals from getting out of protected areas is a very costly intervention to do. For example, if you're in a savanna, you have elephants. For example, look at a park like Queen, which maybe is having up to about 3,000 elephants. So if you are to keep these 3,000 elephants inside the park, then you have to do you have to dig trenches all around.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, so a park of about 1,978 square kilometers. So you have to do a trench all around.
Yeah.
Or look at Chirari, which is around 795 square kilometers. So you have to do a trench, you know, all around to stop them. So doing a trench is very expensive.
Yeah.
You know? And leave alone only digging the trench, you have got to maintain it. You also have communities around who are pastoralists, and they would want to come and graze the animals.
Right.
So you dig a trench here. Tomorrow they have filled the trench with soil.
So that they can move their animals.
To move the animals. So it is the same point that elephants will use for going out to raid crops. And so we see all these challenges taking place. So there is that cost of doing these interventions to stop wild animals from getting out of the park to go and raid crops. So we see that that happening. And then the damage to crops is on one hand, but also you have the predators, they also kill livestock. We see that happen. And then as farmers try to cope with the issues of crop raiding, they gather their crops and sometimes they get trampled. And so where loss of lives is involved, it really aggravates the conflict.
For sure.
The wildlife conflict.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so that sometimes changes the perception of the people regarding wildlife conservation. So instead of them seeing these animals the way me and see it, they see these animals purely problems.
Right.
And wonder why, you know, these animals are being protected, they're being put somewhere else, you know, have all these guards, but your crops are not valued.
And, you know, outsiders, I think, struggle to understand how anybody could not just love and adore elephants, right? They're like, but elephants are amazing.
Yes,
how can you not love elephants?
Yes.
Well, when you get trampled by an elephant, or a family member gets trampled by an elephant, or your crops, even if they didn't get eaten, are damaged for the entire year, and now you can't feed your family, you might not feel so warmly towards.
Yeah.
And we have, and the irony is, right, in the United States, we have the same issues.
Yeah.
We have, of course, we have predators. which are routinely poisoned. If they, even if they're not responsible for killing livestock, they're usually blamed for it. So mountain lions are usually blamed for killing cattle, but they're scavengers 30 to 40% of the time. So often they're not the responsible party, but they get blamed, the perception. And then, of course, I study also prairie dogs. And they're people who live with prairie dogs despise them because they dig holes all over the place and dig up your pipes and ruin your pipes where you live. And but, of course, that was their habitat, right? And we moved into it. And so it's the same, you know, sort of challenge. If there were these wildlife corridors and there were these dispersal areas and those now have disappeared, that almost brings people and wildlife closer into proximity to have these conflicts. So I'm not sure that there's ever going to be an easy solution to that.
Well, there's no easy solution, but I think what needs to be promoted is coexistence. I think for a forested park like Bwimbi, we are almost there. Reason is because of benefits. The gorillas destroy people's eucalyptus, maybe they debark them, or sometimes get into bananas and break a few, you know, branches here and there. But people are not aggrieved because of that. But simply because now they understand that these gorillas are important, and because of tourism, they see the benefits. And so there is tolerance. There is tolerance for damage. So to promote that coexistence, I think that we need to provide benefits that accrue from wildlife conservation, maybe through tourism, to the adjacent communities. And so that they know where is, because after all, in our homes, we have domestic animals. And if it goes and destroys your maize field, you say, well, it's my goat. It's my goat. And so we need to build that tolerance. And to build that tolerance, then we need to provide benefits to the communities. But more importantly, I think that we should, on our part, put in interventions to minimize. You cannot stop the damage completely, but if you minimize it, yes, the damage will be there. It is minimal. And then people are getting benefits from these, from wildlife. Then whatever damage that is caused, they'll be able to tolerate it. And that is when we shall then get the middle position to say, I think humans and wildlife can live side by side.
Well, you know, so that you bring up by bringing in tourism, that's also in part of your background and training. And I'm curious, when did you decide it was important to integrate, you know, tourism into your research and, you know, wildlife ecology background? When did that happen and why was that important to you?
I think I want to say that probably it was optimistic. I was deployed to Matshin. I was warden in charge of a sector. And you know, the concept of ecotourism was beginning to take root at that time. And I was based in an ecotourism center. And so from purely, you know, background of a biologist, I needed to apply that knowledge so that all the knowledge about wildlife could translate this into probably a tourism product. And like I said before, being an educationist, then looking at services that are being offered to tourists, the guides that are supervising, I needed also to share the same, you know, a kind of knowledge with the guides. and give them, you know, techniques of how they can use this knowledge to do the interpretation in order to satisfy our visitors. And so why I'm saying to opportunities that at that time also, we had tourism activities going on, but there was no one responsible for tourism. And so because of having that background of wildlife ecology, knowing the behavior, you know, of animals and so on, and then I was looked at as the most suitable person to probably training in tourism. And so that's when I got opportunity to do a course in sustainable tourism development in protected areas, trying to get at the balance between nature conservation and business.
Yeah.
So that was the training I first did. Then after that, then I went and did another training in community tourism planning. And then, of course, there are other, you know, short courses that I did to do with customer care, you know, communication, you know, all this tourists, the guiding and interpretation and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
To add on to those courses that I did. Then I continued practicing this. Yes.
So how much has ecotourism grown in Uganda?
Actually, what you see in Uganda is ecotourism, because the natural resources are well conserved. Then the kind of tourism that we, or our, when you look at our tourism offers, it is targeting smaller number of people, but high paying. And then we have also integrated culture into it. And so you hear issues of the hospitality of Ugandans. That is part of the culture. It's just the culture of this place.
It's marvelous.
Then two, is the food, the diversity in this country, you can't believe in terms of food. When you go to different towns, you'll get different kinds of food that is prepared. And that shows you the culture of this country. Then the way people live. So when you go to different areas and you go to communities, you know, for community tourism, it shows you the way of life. It shows you the culture of the people in that particular area, their lifestyle, you know, the way they build, the activities, the contact in the households, and so on. All that blends into the tourism that the offers to people who visit our country. And so we have the natural resources being the pearl of Africa, you know, source of the Nile. And you look at this country, very green, very, very beautiful. And so that is what we offer, we protect it. Yeah, the natural resource itself is well conserved to begin with, as an attraction to the people who come in. And then the way we offer it is really to give you high quality experience that is a very unique experience, so to speak, because look, if you are going to do gorilla tracking, we'll limit the number, we'll not take very many people, we'll take 8 people. And so when you're interacting with the gorillas, we want you to get the best experience. And so there is a focus on experience, that the unique experience, the rich experience that we want you to get. And then the culture now blends into it, and so that's what makes the ecotourism brand, the tourism.
So you bring up something really interesting when you mention the gorillas and how you keep the number of tourists at any one time small.
Yeah.
And part of that is to create that experience for the visitor.
Yeah.
But it's also part of it to keep the stress level for the gorillas down. Because what we're finding is that wildlife watching is very popular.
Yeah.
But it's not without stress for the animals being watched.
Yeah.
And so how... If you know, how did the number 8 get decided on? And I know that that it's limited to 1 hour, which is great, so that the gorillas can live their life the rest of the day without eyes staring at them.
Yeah.
But how are these decisions made about time and number of visitors?
Yeah, there was a study that was done. I may not remember exactly by who. Actually, there's a paper which is published regarding this, looking at what would be the appropriate number that would be allowed to view gorillas without causing them a lot of stress. So at the beginning, it was 6. I think it provided a range. So, the precautionary measure, we started with the lowest of 6. And then later, a decision was made to look at, to increase it to 8. So all that was reviewed and was found that, 8 would still be okay. Then it was increased. So this is really based on a study. Yeah.
Well, and this is, again, kind of speaks to something that I think people may not appreciate, which is how much science and research you and others do to make these kinds of decisions. And so research is really important to you. I think maybe what are some of the big kind of research questions that Uganda's wildlife and conservation programs are facing or wanting to tackle? What are the most pressing questions that need to be answered?
Yeah. I think that the issue of habitat is a very critical one. For wind in particular, when you look at the distribution of gorillas in this park, there are certain areas where gorillas don't range at all. They're not inhabited by gorillas. So we need to understand why. Why is it that gorillas do not move, do not occupy those areas? So I think the habitat question is important. We as a country, we had turbulent times in the past. That's where we're coming from. And the wildlife numbers are recovering now. With all these challenges of population growth, if the wildlife population now increases in our protected areas, what will happen? What will be the disposal mechanism, for example?
Yeah.
And so these are questions we need to start thinking about. I was telling you that there are 3,000 elephants, but when we do maybe studies of carrying capacity or what we call limits of acceptable use, if you like, when we reach there, what happens? So to me, those are really key questions to look at. And then I think that we also need to balance our development needs with conservation. We are seeing that as a country, we need energy to develop. And so we find that some of the sources of hydroelectric power, maybe the waterfalls and so on, are in protected areas. Okay? And then also some of our parks have oil. So we like to, extract the oil, as a country for development. So what is the balance?
Yeah.
So you need the wildlife, but also you need some of these resources. You need to harness them, probably for development. And so to me, I think that is also another key thing that needs to be looked at. And if those kinds of developments are informed by research, then I think we'll be able to find a very good balance in this. The other question, the other thing that we need to look at is, well, I'm an ecologist, I look at the scientific part of things, but with all this human population growing around the protected areas, I think we need to look at the socioeconomic part of it. Yeah, the socioeconomic part of it. Because if these communities are not very well, are not well, cannot support their livelihood, then tomorrow they might enter the park and cut down the trees. Because how many rangers do I have? Perhaps 300 rangers to protect Bwindi. But how many communities do I have all around the park?
I don't know. How many?
Many more.
Yeah. Yeah.
A lot of communities. But you see, population density of about 600 persons per square kilometer. So it's in the area of 300 and the 321 square kilometers, the size of Bwindi. So the desert area.
So over a million.
Quite a high population around the park. And so you need to start looking at the livelihoods of these communities around the protected areas so that they're able to coexist. Because if the livelihood needs of these people are not addressed, and the poverty levels are high and they depend on natural resources for their livelihood, then we will continue to see high pressures being mounted on the national parks and also probably resource depletion taking place. And so we should also get interested in the communities around the national park, do a lot of household surveys, what are the challenges that they are facing and so on. I'm quite happy that we have been able to do social assessment of protected areas. For example, how does a protected area negatively impact on communities living next to it? And so those kinds of studies are very good. So the moment you identify those ones, then you start addressing those issues. And then the other one is the also the governance assessment of protected areas. The governance issues are very, very important, because when you mobilize these communities, they need to have capacity to govern themselves. So whatever resources that they get or benefits they get from the national parks, then they can invest it wisely and manage it very well. And if also that is not done, you do not have well-organized communities that are managing themselves very well, then eventually these ones will also have, you know, impact on protected areas. So I think in terms of research and all that, I think we need to get interested into the issues of communities. What are the drivers of all these threats that we are getting, and how can these be addressed? We promote, you know, coexistence to ensure sustainability.
These are big questions and they're big problems to tackle. So that's a lot of responsibility.
Yeah.
And I'm just curious, and then I know you're a very busy man, so I can't take up your entire day, although I can talk to you for hours. How much is climate change impacting different protected areas in Uganda? Not just Bwindi, but in other places?
I think that is it's a major problem, especially in fragile ecosystems. The issues of climate change is that the kind of studies to determine the precise impacts of climate change, I think not much has been done in that area. And so most of the impacts people talk about are really predictive. So the other time I had issues in Mogahinga here, mudslide all the way coming from Muhabura. And you know, Muhabura, close to the peak, that area is rocky. I think the soils there are thin, and when it rained a lot, I think all got soaked, because down there it's rocky and the soil is on the surface, and it got heavy and flake. And so it came down the valleys, and those places are so steep, so it gained momentum and rolled down boulders and so on. and then plus the floods, all this. So when you see all these things happening, we attribute them to, you know, climate change. We have similar things happening in Rwenzori, yeah, torrential rains, all these floods, with devastating effects downstream. We see that happen. So those you see them in those fragile ecosystems. Those disasters, the floods, the landslides, and so on. We see that happening, and of course that has an effect on the habitat itself, because if big areas of the park, you know that slides and all that, so then you lose trees and so on and so forth. You see that happen. Then when you go into arid areas with climate change, it sort of exacerbates the dry conditions. So during the dry period, it gets even drier. And we are seeing issues of drought, we are seeing lack of water for wildlife. And so in places like Toro Semlik Wildlife Reserve and like Mekumburo, so we're beginning to dig dams to hold water, you know, creating reservoirs for wildlife. And these are things which used not to happen.
Yeah.
And so these are really impacts of climate change. And I did talk about invasives.
Yes.
Go to like park like Queen Elizabeth. I think 30 to 40% of the park is taken up by invasives. So that's a very, very big portion.
That is.
Yeah, very, very big portion. It's not only Queen Elizabeth. And so we are also seeing, in addition to invasives, we are also seeing bush encroachment. Now the animal population is low. Now, with all these effects of climate change, you have those species that are quite resistant. Then they are colonizing big areas. So we're seeing a lot of bush encroachment taking place in many of our protected areas. And so that reduces probably the feeding range and so on for wildlife. So those are kind of impacts that we are seeing in our protected areas. But I think it's very important to do research to really document the precise impacts of climate change. What is really the impact of climate change on conservation? And I remember one time telling you that in Rwenzori, it's one thing that we wanted to do to determine those precise impacts, because when they did modeling, they predicted that the air temperature will rise by about 0.5 degrees centigrade in a decade. And that by 2025, that would be no snows, because we're looking at the rate at which the snows were receding. So we're looking at that. But when we started the data collection and all this, actually we found something different. Yes, the air temperature was rising, but it was not at the rate that was predicted. And as I speak now, we still have snows. By 2025, they won't disappear. They will still be there anyway. But of course, it is shrinking. But the rate is slower than what was predicted.
Yeah.
So that's why it's very important to have research look at those precise impacts of change.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. And I think that, you know, you're very serious about your work and you have a very serious job in charge of Windy Mugahinga, not just gorillas, but you have forest elephants, we have pangolins.
Yeah, sure.
It's a hot spot.
But literally, we also discovered there's a honey badger.
That's right. We discovered there's a honey badger because somebody, I don't know who, thought they saw an African wild dog, which I still think I saw it. But to your credit, because you're so, what I appreciate too is your curiosity and your openness to discovering and knowing that we don't know everything, right? We don't know everything. And as scientists, we always have to remember that we don't know everything. And so was this a surprise to you that there was a honey badger here?
It was a surprise because, I mean, it has never been reported before and nobody thought about it. And all of a sudden, we captured in the camera. So where did it come from?
Right. And so who knows what else is here?
But it wouldn't be surprising, though. But you know, these honey, whatever, in these tree trunks and what in the forest. But I think because no one had seen it before, nobody thought about it.
Right.
But
yeah.
There you are.
Well, there you are.
There's a honey bag.
Yes. And, you know, and you're just also such a wonderful and interesting person. And I know that you are very busy. So I will regretfully end the interview and say thank you so much for being on the show. I really appreciate all the work that you do and taking the time to talk with me.
My pleasure. Thanks for giving me the opportunity to give insights on a few of these topical issues regarding conservation. It's always nice to share experiences with people.
Yes, and I always learn a lot from you every time that we talk.
My pleasure.
All right, everybody, that is the end of this week's show. If you want to keep up with Nelson Guma, you can find links to his social media on the show notes at Wild Connection, the podcast hosted by Podbean, or on my website, jennifervertelin.com. One of the things that came up in the conversation, well, many things came up in our conversation. It's obvious that tourism is such an integral part of conservation here in Uganda. And it's growing, and people are starting to discover the pearl of Africa, which is what Uganda is known for. And so I think next time, it's a good time to talk to someone that is involved in the tourism business and what is so special about this country and its people and its wildlife. So tune in next week, and we will be continuing this series, Voices of Uganda. Okay. And if you're digging the show, please give it a like and share it with your friends. Thanks for listening.